Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a highly popular actress and comedian who is perhaps best known for her portrayal of the tough, wisecracking, no-nonsense bailiff Roz Russell on the classic sitcom Night Court. She also played Dr. Maxine Douglas in Empty Nest and Tony Wilson in 911, and she's made guest appearances on dozens of other TV shows, including The Richard Pryor Show, Riptide, Family Ties, Cheers, Touched by an Angel, and many more. And yes, she was the voice of the mail carrier in the Addams Family. And in the early 90s, she even hosted a wonderful talk show of her own, The Marsha Warfield Show. She's also appeared in many great movies, including Doomsday Rock, Caddyshack 2, Anything for Love, Mask, They Call Me Bruce, The Marva Collins Story, Miracles Across 125th Street, Odd Holiday, I Do, and many more. But in my opinion, one of the very best ways to experience the brilliant talent of our guest is when she's being her hilarious and insightful self on stage doing stand-up comedy. And she's been doing that a long time. She won the San Francisco International Comedy Competition in 1979. She's made dozens of appearances on late night talk shows and comedy specials, including Comic Relief, An Evening at the Improv, The Comedy Store, Funny Women of a Certain Age, and most recently, the Netflix documentary Outstanding, A Comedy Revolution. And who can ever forget her classic comedy album, This Is Not Gross, This Is Important, in which she provides a no-holds-barred exploration of the subject on everyone's mind, sex. She's got a fabulous web show on YouTube called Midnight in the Marshaverse, in which she shares her trademark wit and wisdom with celebrity guests in thought-provoking and insightful conversations. She's currently on tour performing to sold-out audiences, and she's funnier than ever, tackling a wide variety of issues, including everything from politics, the realities of being a Black gay woman, and her love affair with pizza. I am delighted to welcome the incomparable Marsha Warfield to our show. Marsha, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you so much for that introduction. I almost don't recognize myself. That's like, I'm impressed.
Well, you should be impressed. You are an icon. I want to start by taking you back to the late 70s when you were working with Richard Pryor on his TV show. What was he like to work with?
Well, you know, for me, Richard was like a comedy god. He was the god. He He was, a lot of people assume that when you work together, you become friends and all that kind of stuff. But he was Mr. Pryor to me. I was 23 and he was at the top of his game. So I was lucky to be there and pretty much awestruck. I was just, like I said, lucky to be there. I was, whatever they wanted me to do, I was willing to do because I could learn from him. But he was always nice to me, and I had met him first doing stand-up at the Comedy Store when he was working out his material for his album that was in progress at that time. I don't remember which one it was, and I probably shouldn't say the name of it on the air, but he was working out his material. I met him there and got to talk to him then, and that was when we, you know, probably had a conversation.
Besides Richard Pryor, who were some of the other role models in the world of comedy for you?
Oh, my first comedy crush was without doubt Flip Wilson. I loved Flip's comedy before he developed the Geraldine character. She was just a voice that he used for all female characters. And then when he did his special, The Devil Made Me by This Dress. He did The Devil Made Me by This Dress, and he named her Geraldine. And she was the only Black woman on TV who had a sense of self and took no prisoners. She was, I am who I am, and you will respect that. And this was even in 1969, 70, 71, was a really fairly revolutionary kind of character on television. And I just fell in love with him.
You know, it's so interesting to me that you mentioned Flip Wilson, because I remember as a young gay teenager watching the show thinking, well, we know he's not gay. We know he's not part of our community, but he's making it okay to do drag, just like Milton Berle did. But I never considered him someone that advanced the cause of our community. Did you?
Well, I don't think anybody advanced the cause of our community in 1969 on network television. I mean, there were people, of course, working very hard in other areas, in politics and the like. But on TV, being gay was always a joke. And so, which made my recent appearance on Night Court so special, because they allowed Roz to be gay and to get married. And that was not the joke of the show. You know, it wasn't like, oh, Roz is gay and now the whole, everybody's hair is on fire. It's like, our friend and coworker needs a place for her wedding and we got to help her. Which I thought was really, really an honor. It was an honor to me from the writers that they saw me that way, that they wanted to write the character that way and promote my sexuality as just a part of who I am. And so to have Dan Fielding walk Roz down the aisle, I thought was just icing on the cake. It was probably one of the best writing gifts I've ever had.
It was really a special moment because they didn't make a big deal out of it. I thought that was very smart that they didn't. You know, when you were talking about the 60s and 70s, I guess there was Liberace, but he wasn't out. So no, we didn't really get to have him as a role model either. You're so right. Now, of course, as I mentioned in my introduction, you'll always be remembered as Roz Russell on Night Court. I don't know how much you know about me, but I am a retired criminal and family court judge. Did you know that?
No, but I do now.
Yeah. I spent 26 years.
I can't imagine why you retired.
Well, I spent 26 years in a courtroom. And then when I turned 65, I retired and followed my dream of hosting this show. And I have to tell you, just so you know, from a real judge, we never had as much fun in our courtroom as you did. Never.
Well, Roz wasn't really part of the fun. One of the things about playing Roz is she was the just the observer. You know, I came in after the show had been set. It was already a top five show when I joined the cast. And so I had to figure out what my role was. And so it was always about me trying to just do my job. You know, I always saw Roz as, look, you guys are invested in this whole thing, whatever it is. I'm not. I punch a clock. I come in. I do my job. I go home. And she commented on the madness. She wasn't part of it. And I always say that my job on Night Court was to walk into a scene where everybody's hair was on fire and they were having some sort of crisis. And Roz would come in and say, you know, that's not going to work. And they'd say, oh, and they'd do their thing and Roz would leave. And then at the end of the show, I'd come back and say, I told you it wasn't going to work. And that was pretty much my job for 6 years.
Well, as you mentioned, you joined the show in season 4. You became immediately hugely popular. I think it was because of two reasons: your no-nonsense humor, your big personality, and secondly, the amazing chemistry between yourself and Harry Anderson, whom we tragically lost in 2018. Can you share some special memories of your time with Harry?
Oh, Harry was a sweetheart. The first day I was on the set, he called me over, and I was so nervous. I had never done a sitcom. I had never done ensemble other than the Richard Pryor show. And so he called me over to the bench during rehearsal and he said, how you doing? I said, I don't know. I'm nervous. I'm not an actor. I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm a stand up. And he said, I'm not an actor either. He said, I'm a street musician. I don't know what I'm doing either. He said, we just watch those guys and do what they do. And so that relaxed me. And the cast was very welcoming and accepting and took me right into the family, which was really something they didn't have to do. And you might not expect that they would, considering they had just lost two actresses that they loved very much. I mean, Selma and Flo were very much loved by the cast and crew. And so they were still grieving when I joined the cast. And so for them to put that aside and embrace me was very special. And I was part of the family, Knockwood, thankfully, from the beginning.
I think a lot of that has to do with your own warmth, your own welcoming personality. And it makes me wonder, are there any similarities between the personality of Roz and the real Marcia Warfield?
I'm sure there are. You know, I used to tell people we're the same height and weight and, you know, we have the same hairdo. I mean, yeah, we have a lot of that in common. But like I said, I'm not a trained actress. And so I had to learn on the fly. And I decided that what the writers wrote, that's what Roz would do. I never had moments like, oh, I wouldn't do that. My character wouldn't do that. And I don't understand or whatever. It's in the script. I'm going to do it. Roz would do that. Roz would do whatever you write her to do. And they always wrote for me to do stuff. I never had a problem. I never had to go to the producers and say, hey, this is not acceptable. They gifted me. So I was very lucky in that regard.
I think you were a gift to us too. Now, of course, everyone knows you made a highly anticipated return to the new Night Court last year. We all got to see you reunited with John LaRoquette. How did that feel, knowing that you're the only two surviving members of the original cast?
Well, it was kind of bittersweet, but we had met a couple of times at memorials. You know, we had met at Harry's memorial service and Marky's. And so I got to talk to John then. And then the show went on the air. I think they had just, when Marky passed away, I think they had just picked the show up. So it was getting on the set was kind of like, it was kind of surreal. You know, it's like if you went back to your prom, in your 70s. And, you know, and the same people are there, but they're all in their 70s. And it was weird in that sense, but it was very familiar because that cast has the same familial warmth that the original Night Court. Night Court's secret, hidden in plain sight, has always been its heart. You know, and if you, all you have is the zaniness, you don't really have a show. Night Court had a heart, that the stories had a message hidden in there somehow. And, you know, it was always about caring in the end and going out of your way to help solve a problem. And so the new cast has that same kind of family feel. And so it was comfortable to be there. In fact, I got to be there on my birthday, on my 70th birthday. That was when we shot the wedding episode. So that was very special on a lot of levels. They gifted me with 70 beautiful, perfect roses, all the same color. They were gifts and cake, and they made a big deal out of it and really made it special.
Well, again, that's because you're special. And I'm fascinated that you mentioned the heart, because I've heard you say in other interviews that what comes from the heart goes to the heart. And that's really the secret of that show.
That's the secret to life. My mentor was a man named Jimmy Cook, and he said, never forget that. What comes from the heart goes to the heart. And you can always trust that. And I learned to trust that. And so I try to keep that in mind at all times, that, you know, how you feel. I think it was Earth, Wind, and Fire that said, ain't it funny how the way you feel shows on your face? Okay, so whatever it is you are feeling, whoever you are, is going to come out. And so you might as well just, you know, get comfortable with it and put forth the positive effort.
Well, I like the fact that the new Night Court is not a reboot of the old show. It's not a remake. It's a continuation. But like you said, it has the same heart as the old show. And you're such a wonderful part of it. Now, you know, for a while, Marcia, you were the queen of the game shows. Now, tell me if I've got this right. I think I've seen you on the Hollywood Squares, Wordplay, Blackout, Relatively Speaking, Win, Lose, or Draw, Super Password, Family Feud, and Match Game. Have I left anything out?
I don't know, probably, but yeah, that's me. I think I did To Tell the Truth and a couple others. But yeah, I wanted to be the next Betty White. I wanted to just do game shows for the rest of my life.
And I wish you a long life, just like Betty White. I want to be here to celebrate your 101st birthday.
Thank you. I always say, I hope you guys will come to my second 70th birthday party.
Now, before we talk about your current web show, Midnight in the Marciaverse, I have to mention your daytime talk show on NBC back in the early 90s. The show had a really unique vibe with a soda machine, fireplace, video arcade, basketball hoop. Everyone knows that doing a daily talk show is a lot of work, but did you enjoy the experience?
Yes and no. I would have enjoyed it a lot more, but the daytime realm is a different realm. You know, I was used to nighttime. I'm a night owl. I did stand-up for 12 years before I got Night Court. I always thought of myself as a stand-up. They wanted a daytime woman's show, right? Is your husband cheating on you? Maybe it's your hairdo. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do more interactive. I wanted to have a show where the audience and the celebrities and everybody discussed topics and played around and sang songs and shot water guns at each other. And they thought that was silly. And so we fought a lot. And that pretty much was what happened to the show. They just couldn't get into the supposed nighttime vibe, I was trying to bring the daytime, even though that wasn't what I was doing.
They made a huge mistake, because I have to tell you, you had so many great guests on that show. And my favorites were the music stars like Smokey Robinson, Della Reese, Helen Reddy, Luther Vandross, Little Richard. Oh my God, you had Lou Rawls, Eartha Kitt, Robert Goulet. I remember them all. And are there any guests from your talk show that stand out as being particularly memorable for you?
Oh, they were all memorable. I met O.J. Simpson when he had just gotten back together with his wife. I met Bill Cosby. I met Eartha Kitt smacked me. I don't know what I said, but she said, "You're so bad." And I'm like, that hurt.
Cesar Romero. Did you do it on the air?
Yes. Cesar Romero, I wanted to have a show where we could have, you know, actors from yesteryear, the greats, the cinema greats. And so when Cesar Romero came on, and he was the same dapper guy he had been in all of his movies, but he was very down to earth. And so we laughed and giggled throughout the whole thing. And I thought that was really, really special. I got a chance to meet him and all of the other, like you said, stellar superstar people that graced the show.
It just makes me so sad that the people in charge didn't seem to understand that the vibe you were creating was so unique on that show. And really, the only one that ever came close later on was Rosie O'Donnell. Nobody else did what you did. They were wrong. I just want to go on record saying it. They were wrong. You had a hugely popular show, and you were right for daytime television.
Well, thank you. And Rosie was one of our go-to guests. She was a young VJ at the time, and she had her first show was so iconic. She came on with Zsa Zsa Gabor, and Zsa Zsa had recently smacked a cop. And so Rosie kept grilling her about smacking the cop, and she could, "Come on, Zsa." And she kept calling her Zsa. She said, "Is it okay if I call you Zsa?" And Zsa, "Darling, you can call me what you want, darling." And they just had this wonderful back and forth. And so anytime we needed a guest, Rosie was our go-to guest. And I'm happy to see where her career has taken her, these many years.
Would you ever consider going back to hosting a talk show?
Sure, in a heartbeat. I would love to. I would love to do a nighttime show. In fact, I was supposed to do a nighttime show, but Warner Brothers NBC said they had the right to first refusal, and they didn't want me to do a nighttime show. They wanted to give me a show. If they gave me a show, I couldn't take the nighttime. And so since their nighttime was stacked, I mean, they had Letterman, they had the late night, after late night, they had all kinds of shows at nighttime, and they didn't have a slot for me. So they gave me a daytime slot. But my goal always was to do a nighttime show.
Well, I think bringing the nighttime vibe into daytime was instinctively very, very smart of you. Tell me about your web show on YouTube, Midnight in the Marshaverse. What inspired you to create that show?
I'm a night owl, and I like to be up at night, and I like to create an environment that is where I understand things, where things make sense to me. Sometimes the world we live in does not make sense to me. And why people do the things they do just doesn't make sense. So in the Marshaverse, we can talk about things from my point of view, and I can have guests, and we can carouse and drink and cuss and, you know, hang out at night, which is what comedians do after shows and stuff. We're up until 3-4 o'clock in the morning in delis and all night restaurants, having coffee and talking about life, talking comedy. So I wanted to do that on my own terms, in my own house. And so that's what I do.
I love it. And it feels like I'm a guest in your home when I watch that. There's a real intimacy to it. And you make everyone feel like you're their friend. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show. Now, Marcia, you took a long hiatus in your career to deal with family matters and to take care of you. And then, thank God, you came back to television in 2021 playing Tony Wilson in 9-1-1. And you also resumed your stand-up comedy career. My question is this: did you make any changes in the way you approached your career when you came back into the spotlight?
No, totally. I was a totally different person. I mean, when I stopped doing stand-up, I was probably 40 years old. And when I came back, I was in my 60s. So, yeah, it was a whole different person. It was a whole different world. I mean, there was no internet. There was barely VCRs and stuff when I was working and doing night court and stuff. And so, yeah, I started all over again. I realized very early that the stage rust was so thick that the only way I could really get up to speed was to start all over again from scratch. So I went back to the bars, to the open mics, to, you know, the clubs, to 5 minutes here, a couple of minutes there, and started all over again and built a whole new act based on who I am now and not who I used to be. I didn't bring any of the old material, nothing, because it just didn't fit anymore.
So what would you say drives your sense of humor as a comic?
I guess if it had to be one word, it would probably be hypocrisy. I think we have so much hypocrisy in the world. We say nobody is above the law, but we have loopholes in the law and that only some people can attain. And we have all kinds of, I often say that the United States is like the United States of hype. If you can hype a thing, if you could say the right magic little words, you can get away with anything. And so the hypocrisy of people who live, our public lives don't always match our private lives, that we are supposed to fit this cookie cutter image, and people just don't. And we're much more interesting when we're who we are. But we have to, in the Black community, call it code switching. We have to, and everybody has to do it. It's not just Black people. Everybody has to have their professional persona, which is often nothing like their reality. And so it's this weird kind of dance we do that just keeps people from being authentic.
You know, and I find that so fascinating to me, because when you first started out, Marcia, doing stand-up comedy, I remember people trying to compare you to Whoopi Goldberg, and that always bothered me because you had your own style. You were nothing like her. So I think that comparison was just a form of racial stereotyping, don't you think?
Of course, because I started in 1974. I don't know when Whoopi started, but I started in Chicago. I moved to Los Angeles. I think she went to the Bay Area. And I started hearing about her from other comics, and that she's, as the Black girls go, she's taking all your gigs. And well, and I'm like, I don't, okay. Yay. But I didn't get a chance to see her. I didn't even get a chance to see her special, the one that launched her career, because I was always on the road working or always out trying to get work at night. So I did. And we didn't have the playback technology. We didn't have the technology. So I didn't know. I had no basis of comparison. So one day when I finally got a chance to see her special, I'm like, what are they talking about? We're nothing alike. She does characters. She does vignettes, and I do stand-up. It's two different, we do two different things. And then as I keep watching, then she takes a street character to Anne Frank's house. I was blown away. How you think of that? How, you know, you could have given me that assignment and a pen and a piece of paper, and I'd still be trying to figure out how to do it. It just is not in my wheelhouse. She was so unique in her thing that I was yay, and I still am. I just did went to her marijuana launch in Venice. She has a company now, Whoop Fam, where she's launching a line of cannabis products. And so I just saw her over the weekend, and we got to hang out and talk, and we're friends. I mean, it just never was a competition in any way at all. I'm happy for her and all of the other comedians, but Black comedians, especially because there were so few of us. And when I came back trying to figure out the landscape, they really had my back. They gave me Kim Woodley, Adele Givens, Sherry Shepherd, Wanda Sykes, so many others. They all embraced me and gave me work and pointed me in the right directions. And so there is no competition. I can't do them. They can't do me. It's not room enough for us in the world.
Well, I think it's so important that you're all there, because comedy, as you know, has always been a tool. And if we look back in time to the movies of the 30s and 40s, especially blackface, comedy was used by white people as a way of mocking and exploiting and suppressing Black people. And then we saw people like Nipsey Russell, Dick Gregory, Red Fox, Richard Pryor. They broke out of those racial stereotypes and they used comedy as a kind of a weapon. And I think you do that too. Do you relate to the use of comedy as a weapon?
Oh, of course. I mean, we're talking the long tradition of the jester making the king laugh or getting unalived, as they say on TikTok. I mean, it's speaking truth to power, so to speak, is what we do. And I have a problem with the comedians nowadays. One, who expect laughs gratuitously from the audience. They expect that everything they say is going to get a laugh. No, you have to earn it. The audience owes you nothing. And so you can't blame them because they didn't laugh. You did something wrong. I mean, it's not their job to accommodate you. It's your job. They did their job when they showed up.
You've often said that you're not politically correct. Do you even have a definition for what is politically correct anymore?
No, PC is, they started saying that, people started saying that to kind of diffuse the power of what was being said about them. So they want you to be politically correct because you're telling too much truth. I think there's no such thing. And my heroes have always been the comedians who punch up. I don't like the comedians who punch down. I don't like to see people mean-spirited. You can be very mean doing stand-up. And there's just no call for it. You know, it's... I've seen comedians disarm audiences physically, literally, take guns out of people's hands because they don't want to take their gun on stage with the comedian. It creates a world for them where they're safe. They feel safe enough to have fun and laugh and be disarmed. And that's the kind of comedy I want to do. It's not necessarily safe comedy. It's letting people know that it's safe to laugh at these things.
Well, has it become harder to make people laugh than it used to be?
No. No, not at all. It's become easier for people who don't see it as an art form to make a living. You know, people who are looking to get into acting, you know, so they do stand up. people who are not political, who are not into, they just want to tell jokes. And there have always been those people. It's easier for those people to find an audience. But to do stand-up, it's the same difficulty, it seems to me, as it's always been. In the early days, when I first started, there was the transition, the technical transition from the supper club comics where a comedian opened for a singer. So if you could find a cabaret singer who needed an opening act and you could travel with them, that was like the epitome of it. And during those times, comedians were protected in the clubs. You know, they didn't allow people to heckle. They didn't, people dressed up and had dinner. And the thing you had to worry about was clinking glasses and, you know, people serving the filet mignon while you were on stage. But so it was a more formal kind of comedy. But now that it's so more relaxed and more people can do it, it's in a lot of ways more democratic, you know, more whatever. And there's something for everybody. And if you didn't like that comic, another one's coming up and got a whole different shtick.
I want to tell you, Marsha, as a gay man, when I came out to my parents back in 1975, when I was 19, they kicked me out and I ended up homeless. And I regretted telling them when I was so financially dependent on them. But you had a very different situation. Your mother asked you not to come out publicly while she was alive, and you made that right. promise to her. How difficult was that for you to wait until 2017 to come out publicly?
Well, my mother passed away in 1995, so technically I could have done it then. But the landscape wasn't right to come out. And for me, in my life, I came out in stages. You know, you come out, first, you come out to yourself, and then I came out to friends. And so everybody in my circle knew, and looking back, everybody knew, but nobody acknowledged anything. And so it wasn't really a hardship not to come out because nobody was out. Like you said, Liberace was gay as a goose, and there were like, his fan base was old ladies who thought he was the perfect son, who just loved him for that. And he kept trying to tell him, darling, and he would say little things that let him know that he was a gay man, and they would just ignore it and come here, let me touch your cheeks. So we had people like Paul Lynn, who, again, flaming, but nobody acknowledged anything. So it was not hard to be closeted because the world was a closet. And I, you know, we've all heard about the closet with the glass door. And we all have seen the celebrities on red carpets with their brother or with, you know, their publicist or somebody. And I don't think we need to talk about my personal life kind of answers. And that was pretty standard. So it wasn't hard for me. It was hard for me to come out. It was hard for me to come out being, I had spent so much time being suppressed and not coming out that I was terrified. So I did it on Facebook. And the world didn't end.
What were you afraid of, do you think?
Judgment, the same, that's kind of judgment that from my whole life. And looking back, you know, you look back and you realize that everybody knew. And I talk about it in my act. I say, they told me I was different, which means they knew. But they didn't tell me. And so that's how I had lived my whole life. And I think there are a lot of people now in their 50s, 60s, 70s who are in that same position. They've always known who they are. They've always felt what they feel, but we were groomed. We were groomed to be straight. We were groomed from birth to you know, play with dolls and all that kind of stuff. I hated dolls. I thought they were the stupidest thing. I mean, it was instinctive. Why are you giving me this dead baby to play with? This baby is not living. It's a little dead thing. And you're telling me that I'm going to be, first of all, and it's pink. What the hell? It never registered. And so there are a lot of people who've lived their whole lives repressing their urges, who they are, or be it sneaking around and not being able, they can't tell their kids, they can't tell their whatever. And if I can do anything and say, you know, look, I did it. I lived that life. I did it. I'm thriving. You can do it too. Don't be scared. Come on. I mean, it's okay. It's okay now.
Well, one of the important things you did, you appeared in an excellent documentary film and TV special entitled Outstanding, an LGBTQ plus celebration, which was historic because it featured the largest known gathering of LGBTQ comics in history. You shared the stage with everyone from Sandra Bernhard, Billy Porter, Rosie O'Donnell, Wanda Sykes, Margaret Cho, Stephen Fry, Judy Gold. Was that a special career highlight for you, Marcia?
Oh, it was a career highlight for all of us. I mean, we were at the Greek Theater, and there's all of this audience. And when we all came out on stage together, Wanda was one of the producers. Wanda Sykes was one of the producers. And she looked out, and we're all lined up. And she looked out and saw this massive audience cheering for us. And she got overwhelmed. And I reached over and said, you enjoy this. You did this. You should be so proud. And I am so grateful. And go ahead and cry. And we had a cry because it was a huge, huge night and a huge event.
It was a beautiful event. I hope that everyone who has Netflix goes to see it. Outstanding, an LGBTQ plus celebration. Marcia, do you feel pressure to be a role model, not only for the Black community, but for the LGBTQ community?
I don't feel pressure. I feel obligated. I mean, I feel it's something that I hope I can do. I hope I can be a positive representative. I hope that people can look at my marriage at 69 and say, hey, you know, you can find love. Old people can have sex. Old people can have cocktails and dance and go party and keep living. I think one of the things that just happened recently that made me so upset is the ageism, and this is political, that has attacked Joe Biden's political campaign, that he's just too old. I'm as a 70-year-old woman, that terrifies me and it makes me angry. How can you be too old? Where's the love of the wisdom that this person has? It's not that we're smarter or anything like that. We've just seen more. So maybe ask me a question and not just shut up, old lady. The world belongs to the young people. I think we miss a really big opportunity to kind of work together and advance society when you make old people disposable and no longer relevant. That really bothered me.
Do you consider yourself an activist?
I consider myself a radical.
But in the best possible way, I think.
Yeah, I wanted to be a radical. I wanted to be a Black Panther, but my mother said no. So I couldn't go out and be a Black Panther.
Yeah, but you're a radical. And for a few years, you were writing a blog called The Caramel Chronicles, but you stopped in 2021. How come?
Oh, it just got to be, there were so many things going on, you know. There are so many different things. Writing a blog took a little more time than I had. And so And I like talking better than writing. So, and that's why instead of writing a book, everybody goes, you should write a book. I'm like, no, I'm going to do my book on stage. And that's where my one-woman show became The Book of Marcia. And I tell my story in stand-up.
Well, you also have your YouTube podcast, The Marciaverse. That's very much your life story, I think. It's a way for us to get to know really who you are.
It's all together. Those same topics that we talk about in The Marciaverse, the planets in The Marciaverse, are the same on stage, wherever I am, wherever I go. The Marciaverse goes with me. And then I comediosify, and I am a sheologian, and I talk to white people because I don't think Black people talk to white people enough. I think we talk about our racial differences and stuff, but rarely do you say, hey, white people, this is how we feel. And talking back has always had a big consequence for marginalized people, for gay people, for Black people, for women. You say the wrong thing at the wrong time to people who consider themselves above you, and you could face some really serious consequences. And I think that's silly. So I try to talk to people and tell truth from a point of view they've rarely heard.
Very much so. You are definitely a hero and a shero for all of us who feel like we're on the outside looking in. Well, Marcia, I only have one more question for you, and it's this. I heard you say in several interviews that your life has at times been turbulent and unsettled. So my question is, are you happy with where you are in your life now?
Yeah, very much. I have a wife. I come out my boo baby. And she doesn't, funny, she doesn't want to be in show business, right? She doesn't like, you know, she's like, I'm just your wife. I'm not in show business. But we go places and they push me aside. And they say, where's boo baby? And everybody wants to meet her. She's a beautiful woman, and I'm very happy that she heckled me. She heckled me, and that's how I met her. I was on stage, and I did a line that I wanted to meet a younger woman, somebody about 50. And she said, right here. I'm right here. And so we had a few words back and forth, and then we met after the show, and she very aggressively told me she found me attractive. And we started talking, and 5 years later, we got married.
Well, congratulations. I'm so happy for you. Nobody deserves it more than you. You waited a long time to be who you are, not just privately, but publicly. I have to tell you, Marcia, it's been such a pleasure meeting you. Thank you for all the entertainment you've brought to the world over the years. Thank you for speaking your truth. Thank you for building bridges between the gay community, the straight community, Black community, whites, the political divide. And thank you for taking the time to appear on our show. I just love you.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm so grateful that you have been so complimentary. I appreciate it very much.
Our guest has been the one and only Marcia Warfield. To learn more about Miss Warfield and see her tour schedule, please visit her official website, marciawarfield.com. And you can see her amazing web show called Midnight in the Marciaverse by going to her YouTube channel, which is showing now on your screen. You can also follow her on Facebook, X, Instagram, and TikTok. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.